Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another one of our weekly COVID updates with Dr. Joe Holly. And that's been something that the people have really been looking forward to. We've been hearing a lot of good feedback about it, and I know Sam has as well. So we'll let Sam take it away.
Yeah, it's been actually nice and warm out here, Jamie, and I'm putting in my garden, and at least it's something to do. It doesn't involve social distancing. So we got Becky here with us, too. We're not going to bug her about the weather tonight, but if she's got any questions on this, we'd love to have her input. Hi, Bex.
Hey, guys.
She's tired of social distancing. She's on here with us. I mean, she needs people. So send her some love on Twitter or something. At least that may help. So, Dr. Joe, what you got for us?
Well, hi, everybody. I hope everyone is doing well. I think from the standpoint of COVID-19, our current, favorite subject, things have maybe settled into a bit of a battle rhythm a little bit for most everybody, not only across the country, but around the world. And systems are in place and working. I think what's been interesting in the last few days is related to cardiac arrest in the current environment. And we've talked some about that before. And we even, I think, touched about a week and a half ago on some stuff that was going on an official high level society sort of approach. And that was really related to concerns from the cardiology folks, particularly through their national and international organizations, related to the management of possible STEMIs during this pandemic and the challenges that they were facing with patients who had abnormal EKGs, chest pain, signs and symptoms that look pretty much acute STEMI, and then going to the cath lab to find out they had clean coronaries and what appeared to be some sort of weird myocardial thing, or potentially, we could spend a bunch of time talking about the hematologic and bleeding related or clotting related issues that are associated with this virus. But anyway, the concern for a while was whether or not the cardiology world was seriously considering sort of altering the current approach to those patients, meaning do they need perhaps an echo in the ED before they go to the cath lab to ensure that they don't have what looks like a COVID myocarditis as opposed to, showing up as a STEMI mimic, et cetera. Anyway, long story short here, the Society of Cardiology basically decided that there really should be no change in the standard of care for these patients, meaning we should not delay getting these folks to the cath lab. We obviously need to be taking appropriate precautions for the percentage of them that are going to show up as COVID positive and realizing that we have atypical presentations. But I think where it sort of settled out was a realization that even if we try to screen them in the ED with COVID testing, obviously, which is more available and faster turnaround than it was 2 weeks ago when this was first coming up, and trying to screen them with echo and all that sort of stuff, that in reality, we ultimately were going to have to cath these people sort of no matter what things looked like. Just to find out what was going on, and a realization that while we need to be careful and it's certainly appropriate and we don't wish to cath a lot of folks for a viral infection, we also don't want to miss those that truly have legitimate STEMIs and need interventional cardiology. So that situation has kind of settled down now to a no real change in the standard of care, and that the majority of cardiology folks, and certainly those in the official international organizations of cardiology, are taking an approach that the standard of care really shouldn't change any with these patients. So I think that is certainly encouraging, and I'm glad to hear that there's been some official information pushed out on that, just to try to eliminate the what I saw is an awful lot of variability suddenly in how these patients were being handled. So I'll stop there and just see if there's any questions or thoughts on any of that.
Oh, go ahead, Jamie. You have a thought? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I know you mentioned this had some, maybe had something to do with the coagulopathy of the COVID virus. Is that still something they're thinking, or is, are they thinking there's some other systemic problem in the cardiology or in the heart itself that's happening?
Well, I think the answer is yes to all of that. It certainly appears that the COVID virus has some effect or causes some sort of coagulopathy. What is quite interesting is that in some people it seems to cause clotting. Matter of fact, there's a lot of inquiry into the ARDS looking picture that sometimes shows up, and that there are an awful lot of micro clots, microthrombi that show up in the lungs during that process, and whether or not that's COVID related or not. But also in some patients, they actually get clotting abnormalities so that they don't clot as well. And so it's a very, very confusing picture. What is very interesting is I'm beginning now to see a lot of folks utilizing thromboelastography, which has basically been used by trauma centers to assess the activity of clot breakdown in sick patients, with the point there being it's a way to analyze how quickly a clot forms and then how quickly it is broken down, and be able to more carefully refine what blood component might need to be given to that patient. In other words, do they need TXA? Do they need platelets? Do they need plasma? What do they need? So the application or the expansion of this tool to these patients as well kind of helps guide that therapy a bit also for things like anticoagulants, heparin, and low molecular weight heparins and that sort of thing.
Well, I'm glad Jamie spelled thromboelastography. Even though I did spell it right, it would have been a shame to not spell that right. Joe, I have a couple questions. And one thing that occurs to me is every time we talk to you, there's been more research, there's been more discussion within groups like the cardiologists, and there's always new things coming along that are making this easier and better, especially on the diagnostic front. But a couple things I keep hearing about that maybe you can touch on is a lot of younger people having CVAs, and the elderly seem to be presenting in some cases with differing symptoms than everybody else. Can you touch on those?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Sam. And I think it goes back to what we were just discussing with the impact that was or that is caused by this virus on the clotting system, with the idea that in younger folks who don't seem to have an awful lot of risk factors for thromboembolic disease, suddenly show up with STEMIs and strokes. And in the older patient population, in many cases, I don't know that I can give numbers on this, but, you know, their presentation related to their hemocoagulability, oh, I'm using a lot of big words tonight, it seems to be much more varied than it does in younger patients. So it's whether, I don't know if we, I don't think that we know whether or not this is related to comorbidities or some other factor that we don't understand yet as far as why the virus seems to be at both ends of the spectrum, not only from an age standpoint, but from its effect on the hematological system.
Aha. And again, I haven't read the details yet because a lot of it just runs by me. But are the elderly showing, I'm hearing about chills and different things that we haven't really heard about so much that might be more present in that population. Have you heard of anything there?
I think we are beginning to see a little bit more of, I guess specificity is the right word to use there. So related to that, for example, it appears the anosmia that we talked about a couple of weeks or months or years ago, I don't know how long ago that was now, where you lose sense of smell and taste, seems to be a much more common presentation in younger patients and in those that tend to have less severe symptoms. Now, the issue with that is that, you know, if you're on a vent, it's hard to know if you're having trouble with your sense of smell or not. So it certainly may be that those folks have also lost their sense of smell. We just aren't able to ascertain that information because there's a tube in their throat and they're on a ventilator. But it certainly does appear when you look at large numbers that symptoms like that seem to be more common in younger patients and perhaps are more common in less severely ill patients. So I think that we are beginning to see these varieties of symptoms that are showing up. And as the numbers of positive patients continue to increase, we get a bit more information about how common it is in a certain age group or a group of certain comorbidities.
Well, I unceremoniously stole Becky's question earlier. She said, I can't have this one. Or no, Jamie told me that. So being as I don't know what it is, I'm going to let Becky ask it.
No, I was going to ask about the strokes. I've read that and sort of the prevalence in people of my age group, which is obviously a bit concerning. My question is, I saw sometime in the last week or so, not sure the exact date, that the CDC actually added 6 new symptoms, which I think are many of which you've been describing. Do we know if when testing is occurring, is that increasing the amount of tests that are now being given because there's additional symptoms? Because I know a lot of these testing were contingent on you having these symptoms.
That's a great question, Becky. And I don't know that we know the answer to that. I think that clearly testing is becoming more available. It is being used much more often. And, you know, whether or not it's specifically in that group or not is difficult to tell. I can tell you locally, for example, that many of the sort of drive up, get tested kind of places are focused on patients with some sort of symptomatology. But we have also been screening asymptomatic frontline first responder kind of folks, i.e. EMS and ED folks, looking to see how many sort of asymptomatic providers appear out there. And for us, it's been 1 or 2 per 100 have been allegedly no symptoms or very minimal symptoms, minimal enough that they didn't really associate it with anything. That makes for a very difficult challenge of sorting out the increasing numbers and whether or not that means there are more people sick or we're just simply testing more people. And there's a larger pool of those that are not sick with it. I think it's probably some of both and maybe a bit more of the latter. As we get more testing out there, we'll find out that there are a lot of people who test positive, but who have been minimally symptomatic, if at all, and have basically recovered and moved on because we simply haven't focused on that group much due to the limited availability of testing.
Well, you'd think it would give first responders a little bit of peace knowing that they aren't symptomatic and they can have a little bit more contact with their families. So well, I guess there's some good in that.
There is, but I think part of the challenge with these tests, and that's something else we can kind of shift into a little bit, is, you know, the we talked about this a little bit before, these antibody tests are a bit of the Wild West right now. There is a lot of variability in these tests. I don't know if I mentioned this before, and if I did, you guys can tell me to shut up, but it was very interesting on the FDA's website a few weeks ago. There were two or three or four companies that were producing antibody tests to COVID-19. And then less than 2 weeks later, there were well over 100. All of those that added on were all listed as not manufacturers, but resellers, meaning they were buying the test from somebody else, putting their name on it, and then turning around and selling it, I'm sure at a nice profit. And so quality control on many of those tests has been poor. I've heard experts basically say they think about 50% of those are completely worthless. But they seem to be getting a bit better. I think the technology is improving. The manufacturing is coming online. The FDA is beginning to get more data back on quality related to some of these things. And we're beginning to see higher sensitivity and specificity with the test. But it still matters when you do the test. You know, if you test someone 2 days after exposure, the chances that they're going to show anything are virtually zero. And if you're looking for IgG, the marker for acute infection, then you have to have the virus floating around in your bloodstream for a long enough period of time for your body to make antibody to it, which is several days. So, you know, you have to, you're probably symptomatic by that time, although you may have initiated your desire to get the test before that. And then if you test after they have quote unquote recovered, you hope to see IgM showing that you've been exposed to the virus and have mounted a antibody response to it, and hopefully you're done. But again, if you test for that too soon, the body's not had time to do that yet, and you won't see anything. So I worry a little bit about fire departments and nursing homes, perhaps, and doctor's offices and that kind of stuff that are eager to provide a test, particularly for their workers. But the folks that many of these testing entities are marketing to are fire chiefs and office managers and people like that who do not understand the subtleties and the important details related to the use of these tests and the right way to do it. And so, you know, fire departments are spending a lot of money to order tests so that they can test all their people, but they have a poor understanding of when they should test them and what the results mean when they get them back. And so I worry that, you know, a lot of money is going to be spent for a test that gives us a result that we don't know what to do with, or that is misinterpreted or not interpreted in context, and therefore leads to bad decisions.
Do you expect the CDC might be putting out some guidelines on that to help assist them understand why a test may or may not work, or they may be infectious or not?
Yeah, I think we're beginning to see a little bit of that. It's not, I think, as much as it needs to be. And I think the medical community in general has a better sense of that, because we utilize, you know, similar type tests for the flu and for RSV and, you know, a million other infectious diseases, Lyme disease and all that kind of stuff. And so we're more attuned in the interpretation and the proper timing of those tests to maximize their value. But a lot of folks that don't have a lot of experience in that simply don't appreciate those subtleties. And I think it's a lot to learn in a short period of time, and there's a lot of pressure to get these tests out and start testing people so that we can, you know, allegedly put people back to work and all those kind of things. And, you know, I mean, you can put people back to work, you know, based on a test, but if your test is only 60% accurate, you're obviously going to miss quite a few. So, you know, there's some risk there that I think people don't appreciate. They want to place a lot of confidence in a negative test, And then they find out that that test isn't so accurate, and they shouldn't have made decisions based on it. You might as well have flipped a quarter and decided heads or tails based off of that.
Wow, that's something we need to continue to talk about, because at least the people that listen to us are going to know what to think about that. Bex, you got a question?
Yeah, well, I just kind of want to confirm what Joe is saying, and that this is something I've heard from a number of different companies, that in order to allow their employees to return back to work, they want to test them. And it hadn't really quite occurred to me that there may be a lot of these flaws that you were just describing. So I just want to confirm, like, the test that these, you know, just regular companies may be acquiring do not have the accuracy rate, or there's, I guess it's two parts. They don't have the accuracy rate that may be needed. And also they don't understand the test itself. So therefore people who are not health officials should not be administering the tests.
Well, so you bring up two excellent points, you are correct on many levels. So let's talk about the differences, right? So the diagnostic test, the sticking the swab in the back of your nose test, is a diagnostic quality test, meaning that test looks for and turns positive when fragments of RNA from the COVID virus are present. So it is exquisitely specific. You either have the RNA there or you don't. There is no body response to that. There is no, I need one more day to get my antibody level high enough to cross the threshold to show up on the test, et cetera, et cetera. So the swab test that's been done so far is a very specific, very accurate test, because it is looking for the RNA of the virus. The antibody tests are not looking for virus particles or anything else. They are looking for your body's response to the presence of that virus by either an IgG, an acute phase response, meaning you're infected, or the IgM, which is a bit longer term, carries the immunity to the virus kind of deal. And those things take time for the body to generate. And depending on the sensitivity of the test, one antibody in a cc of blood may be enough for one test to be positive, and another test needs 1,000 antibodies in a cc of blood to turn positive. So the thresholds vary quite a bit. And obviously the levels that are in your bloodstream are varying over time based on where you are in the process of your infections. So if I've had the virus floating around in me for 3 days, I have, a small amount of antibody present yet. And if it's been there for 5 days, I have a whole lot more antibody present, because the body's been busy making antibodies all during that time. So, you know, that's the details that become very important in making certain people understand how to utilize the test correctly, and to understand that the nasal swab and the antibody test, the serology test, or now actually a salivary test, are not the same animals and have different strengths and weaknesses.
Wow. I've been hearing from some of my California DMATters that they've actually been doing, whether they're real clinics or practice clinics, I'm not sure, but to do the nasal swabbing. So it sounds like that's really catching on. And this other one sounds so complicated. It doesn't seem, this kind of a no-brainer. Jamie, well, you got any? Oh, go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say, so the diagnostic quality test obviously is slower. It's more challenging to obtain. It takes longer to get a result. The antibody tests are, you know, much like how you would do a home pregnancy test, right? You put a couple of drops of blood on a, paper strip and stick it in, and it turns positive or negative in, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, 4 hours, whatever the timing is on those. It'll get better and better over time. So they're much more rapid in their response capability, and it takes much less skill and manpower to be able to obtain the test. But again, you have to balance that against what it is you're looking for and what you're trying to prove with it.
A lot of factors there. Jamie, thoughts?
I'm really glad we had Becky on the call tonight, because I think it was important to have somebody else's viewpoint and questions to add in. And Becky, that was some important questions there that needed, I think, some good clarification from Joe. So thank you.
Sure thing. He's really got me thinking now.
She's really good. We should have her on
somebody is.
Well, no, it's good, because I'm a part of a corporation that's having these discussions. You know, we have 500 people between three offices, and we're obviously having these discussions on when can our employees go back to work. And I don't know for certain if that question has been asked on, like, can we test our own people? I have no idea of the legality and ethics of that. But should that be something they're considering, I want to bring to their attention, like, hey, this is not as simple as you might think it is.
That's right. And I think that's the real key here, Becky, is that folks, if you don't understand those subtleties, then you get test results that are all over the board and you have no idea what to make of any of them. And so in the big picture, they are completely useless, because you don't know how, you know, is it 50-50? Is it 70-30? Do we just need to wait one more day? Do we test too early? Do we test too late? What are we looking for, et cetera? If you don't understand where you are in the process, then the results are meaningless. And, you know, people spend a lot of money and make decisions that could be pretty impactful on somebody else's health based on a test that they didn't understand in the first place and got sold to them because, you know, somebody was cheaper and could get you 1,000 tomorrow and you could put all your people back to work right away. Well, that may or may not be true. So as with all things where people are trying to sell you something, buyer beware on what you're buying and how well it works.
Companies or organizations like fire departments and such can rely upon their county or state health departments to provide guidance for them?
I think that we're beginning to see a little bit of that. I think that health departments will have some involvement here, but are probably not likely to be very educational beyond their own walls. Due to the fact that they're going to say a nursing home, a doctor's office, et cetera, you know, there should be a physician involved there. That's his job. And, you know, we're not going to be pushing out information that the physician at that institution should understand, who orders, you know, tests for whatever, whether it's Lyme disease or hepatitis or anything else. You know, if you don't understand what those test results mean, you shouldn't be ordering the test. So to me, the issue here really is I would just plead with fire departments, particularly because that's what I do all the time, to be patient and to really spend some time with their medical directors to ensure that what their plans are with testing medically make sense and are worth the investment in time and money.
And it might be what they're going to get out of it. Companies in the private sector, Becky, to maybe look into getting a temporary medical director on staff or on retainer to be able to provide some insight.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea.
That's a great idea. You really need somebody that understands these tests to advise you on the right way to do it. None of these tests are difficult to do. It's just, what do you do with the results once you get them? And that's the devil's in the details there.
Well, Joe, you need another job. We can save all the meteorologists at AccuWeather.
Yeah, I'm looking for work
crickets.
Right now. I'm looking for
Jamie,
work.
I'll bet you are. Well, I think we've about run out the clock here because I'm sure Joe has phone calls coming in and other people needing him.
So, Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you. And Becky and Sam for getting together and coming in on this COVID update. A special thank you to Paragon Medical Education Group. There are links at the website, links on our Facebook group, and links on every episode. Make sure you give them a shout out and check out what they have available for you. And we'll just kind of let this go. Our regular episode will be coming up later this week. And we just want to thank everybody for coming in and listening to this update. We'll try to bring more to you as more information is available.
Thanks so much, guys. Enjoyed it as always. And welcome to all of our new folks on our Facebook page. We're so glad to have you.